I think being generous with people is selfish and self-interested, and that's okay. But I just get a lot of joy out of seeing people connect with each other and learning from each other and doing great things and rooting for them, and rooting for their success.
What's going on, my fellow Bitcoiners? I'm John Chenault, and welcome to episode 15 of the Bitcoin Path podcast. This is a show where we have deeper conversations about Bitcoin and self-sovereignty, about how this new magic internet money is changing the world and changing ourselves at the same time. In this episode, I get to share with you my conversation with Corey Clipson. For those of you who don't know Corey, he is the founder of SwanBitcoin.com, and givebitcoin.io. He also serves as an advisor to Unchained Capital and Riot Blockchain and is partner in Bitcoin Ventures. As an advisor, he has supported more than $250 million of fundraising since 2016. And as an angel, he's invested in more than 20 VC-backed tech companies. In our conversation, I talked with Corey in depth about what inspired him to become so highly focused on networking and what practical strategies he's implemented throughout his career. This is a tremendous resource for those of us who are looking to grow our own social and professional networks, to expand our influence, and really to contribute to Bitcoin's growth at the same time. We also talk about Clubhouse and how Corey thinks that it holds the potential for extreme growth as a platform this coming year. And speaking of Clubhouse, I do have a few invitations at the moment, so if you're interested in joining to check it out and see what it's like, reach out to me on Twitter. I'd love to share them with a couple listeners to the Bitcoin Path. Find me on at John Chenault, and we'll coordinate the invite from there. Corey is an exceptional conversationalist, and I really wanted to include the pre-show conversation of this episode really to showcase this. Be sure to follow him on Twitter at Corey Clipson, and check out swanbitcoin.com for setting up your personal automatic dollar cost average, as well as one-time purchases of Bitcoin. Swan is really the simplest, easiest on-ramp for getting into Bitcoin right now, and it's great. Recommend you check it out. So with that, let's get into this episode.
Hey.
Hey, John. Nice to meet you.
You too, Corey. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
You were great in Pirates of the Caribbean, by the way.
Thanks, man. I tried to keep my, you know, identity under wraps, but
I always figured he was a Bitcoiner. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, it's funny. As I've grown out my hair, I've gotten more like Johnny Depp doppelganger comments. But beforehand, like back when I was in my early 20s, I would get James Franco all the time. Like,
nice. Tough life.
I know, man.
Getting mistaken for James Franco. And I usually get like, I think there was a guy on Wings, which was like a 90s sitcom. That's like my main one. And then, sometimes Jeremy Sisto, who was like barely a star for like a heartbeat in the late 90s, early 2000s. I'm not getting any of this fucking Franco, Johnny Depp shit.
I can see a little like Heath Ledger.
That happened once. I also got a Paul Walker once, and I basically lived on that one for like 3 years. I was just so happy about it. But I had much shorter hair, and I was much more jacked and tan.
Right. The ego is a
fucking ego. Bitcoin will smack it out of you, though. I'll tell you that.
That's very true.
Where are you right now?
I'm in Miami at the moment.
Yeah, nice. Are you there for a long time, or is it a temporary thing?
It may end up being a longer time than I thought. I was I've been in Chicago for like 15 years.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's
14
cool.
years this month, and before that, I was in California. But Chicago's just—it's shut down. There's nothing to do.
It's cold as fuck too.
It's cold.
I remember one time because I lived in Chicago for a long time, and we used to always go to Miami, you know, all winter, basically, like as many weekends as you could fit in. And I remember when Shore Club was hot, like one time we counted the 32 like cabanas and beds around the pool, and 15 of them were from Chicago. It's like almost half, 15 out of 32. It was like,
yeah,
we just fucking, because Chicago's cheap, but you can make pretty good money. And so like, I don't know if there's any city that like more people just travel from in the winter.
Yeah. All the snowbirds, you know, they like coming down to Florida.
Cause like the rando mid-level employee in New York can't afford to travel, but the rando mid-level employee in Chicago absolutely can.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. It was funny when I first got here. I got here right before New Year's, and that week, I think there were like 80,000 people that had flown in to the city just within the previous week.
Jesus.
And you know, a lot of them were just vacationing for New Year's and everything. But
right,
I just wonder like how many are just staying as well. Like I talked to a lot of people from New York, and you know, everyone's just fed up with the lockdowns and stuff, and they want to be somewhere where it's nice and open and
for sure
be free.
So, yeah. So I was in Chicago 02 to 04 and 06 to 13. So we overlapped, sounds like, for about 6 years, probably.
Yeah.
Like 07 to 13.
Were you working in Bitcoin at the time or?
No, I got into Bitcoin in 2017. Gotcha. I worked for Google at that 20 West Kinzie office from like 2011 to 2013. And then before that, I was at Bridge Strategy Group, which is management consulting. That office was, I don't know the fuck that office was. I honestly don't remember. I think it was like, it was the edge of the loop. So it was by the river on the west side of the loop.
West
and then, maybe on Franklin, actually. I think it was Franklin. And then, I was doing private equity before that in River North. And I lived almost all in River North. I was at like 600 North Kingsbury, 653 Kingsbury, 720 Larrabee. The last place when I got with my now wife, we lived at 920 West Madison.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. You're a regular Chicagoan then.
So if you're in Chicago, let me see hold on. Let me see if I can recognize the building behind you. Let's see.
You're
in Chicago. Miami. Sorry. Yeah, I was going to say, sorry. Yeah. You wouldn't be outside in Chicago.
I'm probably doxing my location, right? If I publish this on YouTube, right?
That's true. You probably would. And wait, are you in one of those, is this the downtown ones by American Airlines Arena?
I'm in Brickell.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so, yeah. It's very cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice, dude. Yeah. It's great. I really do like South Beach a lot. It was really, we tried to move to Miami instead of LA, but I was getting into startups and venture capital, leaving Google, and there was just not enough going on there. Hmm. Not enough people working remote either. So like, it's not, I think today it wouldn't really matter, especially being a little older with a good network. But back then, you know, I needed to go to all the cocktail parties. I needed to go to all the conferences. I needed I used to take day trips on Southwest from LA to San Francisco, you know, twice a week. I once went 4 days in a row, still sleeping in my own bed at night. I did surf air for like a year, which was like the, you know, just show up at Burbank and hop on a plane
thing.
So it was like,
just to like get into that community,
just get in there,
socialize, and
you had to, otherwise you can't get into deals. You can't get work. Like you kind of, most people that do well in Silicon Valley are either like born there, went to school there, or were at least there in their 20s. And I was trying to play catch up, you know, at 35.
Right.
So I just hit it hard.
Yeah. There really is that. One of my mentors always said, like, you have to be where the money is. Like go to where the money is. If you
value money.
Yeah. If you want to make money,
want the money, go to where the money is. Well, the money's on the internet now, so I think we're good. Have you been playing with Clubhouse yet?
I have. I got somewhat addicted last week.
Yeah.
Just kind of listening in. It's really, really pretty cool.
I think I've seen your name on there. Chanot is pretty memorable. Have we seen each other in some rooms?
I've just been kind of listening in. I haven't really commented much or got involved. I just like to observe for a while before I really like dive in. But yeah, I've jumped in on a couple, and I like how at any time you can just jump in on any conversation going on about Bitcoin, and
blows my mind. It's 24/7.
And you're like having noobs ask questions to experts, and it's very, it's just a fascinating discussion, because a lot of the podcasts and everything that we listen to, it's, or articles that we read, is all sort of in the siloed Bitcoin.
I mean, we're about to record a podcast, but wouldn't that be like more fun to listen to American HODL argue with some ETH people?
I know, right?
Like the clickbait titles are half the fun too.
Well, cool, maybe, man. We should be streaming this on.
People are. They're going both directions. Yeah, I mean the Black Bitcoin Billionaires, their weekly show, they live stream it to Facebook. So they do it in Clubhouse, but they live stream it to Facebook. We're going to start doing that as well. So we set up Cafe Bitcoin as our club, and we have like a Bitcoin for Beginners show that Brady is doing, and we're going to start live streaming that. I also want to have a room that we open every morning, and we'll probably start that within a week or so. So 6:30 Eastern time, we'll be there, as the mods and kind of controlling who's in it and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And, this big influx of Bitcoiners over the last few weeks, like, I'll be honest, was mostly me. Because I got on there and it was just like rife with shitcoiners. And there was that tiny little Bitcoin group with Alex Thorne and Jeet, basically. And, they were just getting all these Bitcoin rooms that said Bitcoin in it were just being controlled by shitcoiners.
Right.
And I just went fucking nuts. And I started that Telegram group to coordinate invites for Bitcoiners. And we've probably brought on like 500 maximalists in the last 3 weeks. And all the famous podcasters and authors are on it now. And it's these rooms are now well staffed. If you use Bitcoin in the title of your room, a Bitcoiner will be there to tell the truth.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely refreshing, because some of the conversations that I'm just like, oh my God, like there's so much. I imagine before all the actual Bitcoiners were in there, it was even worse. Just like knives in the ears.
Yeah. I mean, they just, I don't think they understood maybe I just kind of like saw what that platform was very quickly, and they didn't have the time for it, or just were kind of thinking about it in a very limited way, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the shitcoiners understand marketing, or enough of them do, because they depend on it. They really depend on it.
Yeah.
They're nothing without marketing. Like, Bitcoiners get complacent because the thing is so fucking good, and sometimes we're not good at marketing tactics.
Yeah, it begs a question that I actually wanted to talk to you about. And
should we get going? Yeah, you can ask everything on the show.
Yeah, definitely. Corey, welcome to the show, man. And I don't know if you're comfortable with me sharing some of our previous conversation.
Anything you want, John.
Cool.
It's good to be here. Congrats on launching the pod, and happy to share anything about me, Swan, anything we want to talk about. Clubhouse is the topic du jour.
right.
Whatever you want to hit, man.
Yeah. So one of the questions that I had for you, Corey. Well, first of all, Corey, can you just provide a brief introduction to yourself and to Swan and what you're up to?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm the founder and CEO of SwanBitcoin.com, and we sell Bitcoin in all 50 states and U.S. territories. And we try to make it the easiest, fastest, cheapest, safest way to get started with automatic recurring purchases. And for that, we do it about 60 to 80% lower fees than Coinbase or Gemini, and about half the fees of Cash App. And we can do that because we're Bitcoin only and we don't sell all these other things and we don't really need much marketing because people love Bitcoin and they love telling people about Bitcoin services. So we really focus on education. Like our whole team is basically made up of writers and podcasters and people putting out educational content about Bitcoin. And, you know, we firmly believe, and I think it's true that, you know, the amount of value that someone is willing to store in the Bitcoin protocol is directly correlated to their understanding of Bitcoin. So it's really all we have to do is help people understand Bitcoin better and they'll buy more of it, which is, you know, really all in sync with what's good for Bitcoin. So that's what we do at Swan. We also have one-time purchases, so people can absolutely do smash buys, and you can do that with instant ACH. So, you know, buy now, we'll front you the money, and then the cash settles later. And then we also have increasing numbers of, you know, companies and high net worth individuals and family offices using wires. So we do have a lot of customers buying millions at a time as well now, which is pretty cool. We'll be launching Swan Private here in a couple of weeks. So if you get this out before, you know, Feb 5 or Feb 10, people will know that this is happening before anybody else. But that's that sort of like white glove concierge service for the high net worth folks. Okay. So that's Swan. And then, you know, my own background is had a long career in big tech and management consulting. So worked for, Microsoft, Morgan Stanley, McKinsey, and Google, and then also ran my own private equity consulting firm for a couple of years, MBA from University of Chicago. But I actually started my career in broadcast journalism. So I got journalism undergrad, and I was a really crappy local NBC TV reporter. And so that's part of like the comfort with media and sort of having a content-focused marketing program at Swan, I think, comes from that early background. I got into startups after leaving Google in 2013. And so for the last 7.5, almost 8 years now, I've been investing in early stage Silicon Valley, you know, venture-backed startups, advising CEOs on strategy and fundraising, and occasionally operating when I find something interesting to work on. I went hard down the Bitcoin rabbit hole in spring of 2017, attracted by the price action like a lot of people. It took me almost a full year. It was 11 months to do the shitcoin horseshoe, where you're like worried that, you know, Facebook is coming around the corner and Bitcoin might be MySpace. Kind of got through that by March, April of 18 and started figuring out, okay, how can I mean, Bitcoin's such a mind virus. I couldn't not work on Bitcoin. So I was trying all sorts of different things. Tried to like set up my own sort of OTC desk trading something operation first. Then I tried to work on something with the original founder of Arca Funds, actually on a closed end Bitcoin fund that would be like 80% Bitcoin, 20% levered treasuries, and sell that to, you know, portfolio managers in Wall Street. He ended up selling that to Galaxy. And I kind of just like through that process of about a year of futzing around with trying to do something more for, money managers, I realized I had no interest in that whatsoever. And I really wanted to go directly to the people and create a consumer product. And I wanted to do it, you know, essentially remote, because I've, you know, got a family and young kids and I want to spend time with them. I don't want to go to New York over and over again and shake hands and do stupid meals and things like that. And those people are not actually passionate about Bitcoin in the same way that individual humans are. It doesn't change their life if, you know, 0.5 of their portfolio, that's other people's money anyway, goes into Bitcoin. It just doesn't matter. So it was kind of just like the passion and engagement of mixing it up with Bitcoiners and the plebs and the, you know, Telegram groups and Twitter was just so enjoyable. It guided me toward what needed to be done. And then it was the noisy people like Friar Haas and Pierre and others that were, you know, trumpeting Bitcoin as a savings technology and you should think about it like a 401k or a mortgage and just set it and forget it. And that kind of laid the guidepost toward the product that we would eventually launch as Swan. So we launched March 30th of 2020. It's been about 10 months now. And, you know, it feels like it's been many, many years. And a lot of people think that it has, but no, we're still pretty new.
10 months
that Swan since has been launch. In market. It's crazy.
It is crazy. I mean, I feel like it's been a year since I've been... not even a year, probably about 10 months since I've been fully down, like narrowed down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. And, you know, it feels like a very long time.
Well, we're like 100% of your concurrent time in Bitcoin,
right?
Or at least as a maximalist.
Yeah, so in my perspective, you've been around forever.
We're OG. We've been here since like March 2020, bro.
Yeah, right.
But no, it's been pretty amazing. For me, probably just the people that you get to work with and the people you get to talk to and engage with, and just how sort of unifying and focusing Bitcoin is when you have that as a common goal and a common language and a common topic of interest, then it makes people much more interested in the other things that a Bitcoiner might have to say. And almost like Chatham House rules, or, you know, a group of people that might work at different banks, but they all went to Harvard or something like that. Like, you can have a lot of different views across the political spectrum or on really contentious issues and still be totally cool with it. And not only that, you want to engage with them because you know that they have a fundamental understanding of the world and how it works that is shared by very few. Few understand this. And so I'm kind of enjoying that as well. I'm really enjoying the depth of the relationships that Bitcoiners can build with each other because of that shared understanding of Bitcoin.
100%. I really agree with you there. And I've experienced the same thing. And one of the things that I've thought about it is it's almost a way to, you're able to know certain things about someone else by the amount of engagement and passion that they have in Bitcoin, or the amount of buy-in that they have in Bitcoin. Like if they're trusting this network to hold a large portion of their net worth, or just like they're involved in the community, you know that they value truth to a certain extent. And those are the kinds of people that you like to interact with more and more, right? And you value their opinions on other things.
And there's certainly, listen, Bitcoiners argue about so many things that it's clear we're not all right about everything. but I think, you know, we're right about one very important thing that's really hard to be right about. And that means that you're a bit of an iconoclast many times. And then, you know, you're probably seeking truth, or you're open to learning about it and learning about other perspectives. Otherwise, you never would have found Bitcoin this early in the first place. I mean, what?
Certainly.
1 to 1.5% of all people on Earth even own a sliver of a sat, you know? And some much smaller percentage of those people, you know, actually have like a good chunk of their net worth in Bitcoin, or are, you know, contributing a good chunk of their paycheck into Bitcoin. So it's super early. It is a privileged few that have, you know, passed an important test early. They finished early. They dropped their pencil and they're already, but down at the cafeteria, like sucking down a Coke. And everybody else is still like cranking away, trying to show their work.
Yeah. Even though coming in at 2020, you know, for me, I knew about it early on. And of course, coming in really hard in 2020, I obviously feel late. It always feels like you're late to the party. It really brings things to perspective, you know, looking at the actual numbers.
Well, so. I think you came in at a great time. I've been on record quite a lot since spring of 2020, but I thought that 3-ish month period of bouncing between 9,000 and 12,000, kind of after MicroStrategy announcement and Paul Tudor Jones coming out in favor of Bitcoin, and the price, you know, essentially being artificially suppressed for a few months, at least through the end of Q2, just because a bunch of people were selling covered calls and trying to like not lose their Bitcoin. I thought that was the best risk adjusted time to buy Bitcoin since $2.
Because the risk
so much. It was just so de-risked. Like, it really should have been where it is today. Like, it should have been 30-35 grand in May, June of 2020. And yet it was still sitting there, you know, at half of all time high. It was such a good time to stack sats. I mean, I I turned over every cushion. I called every founder that I ever invested in or ever had advisor stakes and asked if anybody wanted to buy my shares. Like it was ridiculous the lengths that I went to try to stack more sats in Q2.
Right. Right.
Plus I was like, I saw the early enthusiasm of the Swan launch and seeing, you know, sometimes when you're in the Bitcoin Twitter echo bubble, like you wonder if that's all there is. Mm-hmm. But then when you throw out a service and like a tenth of your customers, maybe in the first 3 months are people you've heard of before. And all of the rest of them are just like totally random people that would never touch Twitter. And it's like boomers and it's doctors and it's, you know, people across all ethnicities and 80-year-olds and 18-year-olds. And you're like, oh, got it. Okay. This Bitcoin thing, it's got some legs, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I got just ridiculously bullish. And I think we all did. Jan used to talk about, like, I remember him answering a question on a podcast in like 2019. And it was like, how much of your Bitcoin will you sell at $100,000? And his answer was something like, you know, oh, probably like 75% of it. You know, it's okay. I can let some other people have some sats. And, you know, I think just immersing yourself full time in Bitcoin changes that completely. So he started working on Swan in December of 19. You ask him that question today and he's never going to sell, and he's not going to let his grandkids sell any either. They're just going to use it as like, you know, loan collateral, but there will never be like another sat sold by the Pritzker family.
It's crazy how much, like you were talking about the education and the belief and conviction in it, really flips that dynamic. It's so true. So Corey, one of the things that I'd like to get into right now, and I want to be respectful of your time, obviously.
Oh, I'm good, by the way. We can go for as long as you want, 45 minutes, hour, whatever.
Cool. Awesome. So you have, you know, established just an amazing track record of being in really key places and key relationships that have like fostered an enormous amount of value for everyone involved. And to me, that's like one of the key parts of being a great networker and being able to like connect the dots and bring value into your relationship. So I just wonder, was there some kind of like inspiration? Like what is it, about your personality or like upbringing or something like that, that kind of led you to that, to pursue that track?
So I guess a good article that kind of describes the approach, which it resonated with me because I felt like I was kind of already doing it, but then I realized, okay, you can kind of like do this a little bit more systematically and actually think about life this way, was a New Yorker article from probably 99 or 2000 or something like that. Anyway, it was called 6 Degrees of Lois Weisberg. And it ended up becoming a couple of chapters in The Tipping Point. So it was a Malcolm Gladwell article, and it was about, the author was her son. I think his name was Jacob Weisberg. I think he was like a Slate writer and editor for a long time. And I'm sorry. So the author was Malcolm Gladwell, but it was about Jacob's mom. And she was like on the cultural commission or something like that in Chicago. And she had a nice, you know, flat that she'd had for decades bordering on Lincoln Park. And it had a nice salon kind of overlooking the park. And she used to just invite people over all the time. And she'd have people over deliberately that were from different walks of life, and like put them together because she thought they'd like each other, or because she kind of wanted to see, you know, she wanted to see the conversation and see what would happen if you put, you know, like, you know, Miles Davis with, you know, one of the Chicago Cubs, you know, contemporaneously or something like that. Or she'd get some, you know, some professor together with some, you know, diplomat and a financier and an entrepreneur, and just kind of like throw them in the mix. And it's that kind of salon culture, a movable feast, which is a Hemingway book that talks about, you know, Paris in the roaring 20s, you know, that kind of vibe. I've always really enjoyed that. Nassim Taleb, who's probably my favorite author and thinker, always talks about, you know, basically the best use of any human's time on a given evening is to go to a party. because you get all your news filtered. You don't have to read anything, like whatever people are talking about at the party. You can save hours and hours of going through newspapers and magazines and all kinds of crap and just ask somebody like, hey, so what's interesting these days? And you get to meet people, right. But you can also walk away anytime. And if the party completely sucks, you can always just leave. But it's just, yeah. it's basically like, I think engaging with lots of people and adding value first is really just picking up free call options all over the place. You know, like it doesn't cost you anything to be nice to somebody. It doesn't cost you anything to go on a podcast that has, you know, I'm not talking about yours, but I've been on a bunch of podcasts and I just say yes, because I don't really care. Like it might become big or it might not, but it's going to make somebody that has 6 viewers feel good and maybe get better, and they might become a really good podcaster and they're going to remember that, you know? Mm-hmm. So I always try to do that, you know, whether it's, we were talking in the pre-show just a little bit about, you know, like someone like Andrew Edstrom, who wrote a book about Bitcoin because he was passionate about it. He didn't know any of the Bitcoiners. He happened to be in LA. He sent me a copy. We went and grabbed lunch. And, you know, he ended up investing in the company, becoming an advisor to Swan. We started introducing him to other podcasters. And now he's like a freaking, you know, Bitcoin media star. And he's quoted in Scaramucci's Skybridge deck. And, you know, he's just becoming like this big public Bitcoin figure. And like, and of course, like he likes Swan. So he does mention Swan on some of these shows. Mm-hmm. And like, that's good enough. You know, he's getting on, he's getting in front of audiences much bigger than our own audience. And he talks about Swan, and that's that is the exercise of the call option. But I didn't know what it was going to be when this enthusiastic, super aggressive guy just wanted to hang out and talk. And by the way, I'll tell this story. We've talked about it in front of a few audiences, but I don't think on a podcast. I was supposed to have lunch with Andy in Westwood, right by UCLA. Or maybe we were supposed to be in Santa Monica. But anyway, I pulled an audible at the last second because a VC that I was friends with turned out he was moving to New Zealand and he was having like one last lunch with a bunch of people. So it was like 15 people at a lunch at a Napa Valley Grill by UCLA. And I was like, can my friend come? This guy that I've never met before is probably right. going to be, I don't know what. So Andy came and the round table was like, so it was 15 people around a big table at this restaurant. And, you know, they basically, you know, it was one of those things where they went around the table and asked people like, you know, what are you most excited about for the next decade or for the future or something like that? And of course, we just like absolutely bludgeoned the entire table into submission talking about Bitcoin. And Andy brought a backpack and like forced his book on everybody and was signing nice. For people. And it just turned into this whole Bitcoin thing. And like, you know, it was basically like, well, Bitcoin's going to fix that. Bitcoin fixes that. Like just this hilarious, hilarious bonding over Bitcoin, in front of that group. And, yeah. So I think that's really what it comes down to. It's, I think being generous with people is selfish and self-interested and that's okay. But I just get a lot of joy out of seeing people connect with each other and learning from each other and doing great things and rooting for them, and rooting for their success. I don't know.
Yeah. I think that's spectacular. And I've honestly experienced the same thing as I've just had a pure curiosity in other people and just loved getting to know people, going and socializing and experiencing new things. And even though at first it was very scary, or like, you know, a lot of people have a lot of anxiety around being in party environments and social gatherings and that kind of thing. But the more I like went beyond that uncomfortability and just open myself up to people, the more opportunities and like, and just interesting, fascinating little rabbit holes open up to you. And I wholeheartedly agree. It's just amazing. We just recently hosted just a brunch on Saturday afternoon this last weekend, and you know, had like 15-20 people show up to our apartment and just had like an amazing time. I probably spent like 5 hours cooking like quiches for it. Nice. Just because like I wanted to try to like do something interesting. We tried to make it like super nice and spent like the whole day Friday preparing for it. But you know, it was just really fun to create this little like world where new people came and they all met each other, and like, who knows what could have come out of that, you know?
It's pretty neat. Someone, I think right when I started at Google in 2011, somebody gave me a copy of Never Eat Alone, the Keith Ferrazzi book, which was pretty mm-hmm. cool. And then when I got to LA, pretty quickly, just randomly, like the head of sales at one of the startups I was helping out was had been working for Keith prior to that job. And so he introduced us, and I realized like, so what he does is, and obviously COVID has messed up this thing, but it's every Saturday for years now, he has purchased brunch at a West Hollywood restaurant for like 20 to 30 people. So basically everyone he meets and everyone who gets introduced to him, you know, who's like remotely interesting and like not an obvious scammer, he just uh-huh. invites them to brunch. Right. And they come, and he doesn't have to do, you know, one-on-one brunches and coffees with all these people. He can kind of like buy everyone brunch for $20 or $30 or whatever it is mm-hmm. and kind of do the rounds and have a good chat. He always does like a big workout. So some of the people actually go work out at a gym across the street. So they're all like sweaty. So it's kind of casual or whatever. And then there's the big brunch. And then that's kind of like his top of funnel for new relationships. And then like, he also hosts much more intimate dinner parties up at his house and stuff like that, or does business with people or whatever, but having that sort of, funnel. Anyway, it was kind of right after reading that book, I was like, you know, just organize something regularly that people can come to. So I started something called Tech Salon Monthly. I couldn't commit to like weekly, but you know, once a month on a Wednesday, it was like the third Wednesday of every month, something like that. And I still do it today when I can get a physical location. But yeah, for the last decade, the third Wednesday of every month, I've had Tech Salon Monthly, and it's open to like, you know, VCs and startup people, and just come and hang out. And I buy the food, you buy your own drinks. So there's no like freeloaders there. Usually mm-hmm. people go to things for free drinks. right. But you know, it's, I don't even know, like it hasn't cost me much. It usually you're buying appetizers for like $100, $150. You do that once a month. It's mm-hmm. just nothing compared to all the relationships that you make and all the people that you get to know and all the fun. I've had so many people start businesses and do partnerships and things like that just from meeting at those things. Mm-hmm. And it's socializing and hosting and giving people like a way and a place to hang out is its own reward.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's fascinating. Yeah. It just fascinates me. And that's why I'm very excited about it. And that's why I've like been very intentional about, while I'm here in Miami, I'm hosting multiple Bitcoin meetups. I'm like hosting these brunches with my roommate. Because it is, it's like one of those things that has such minimal output, like minimal effort, like just setting up. For instance, I hosted a Miami Bitcoiners meetup on Thursday, and all the work was making a little graphic and setting up a meetup page and then posting about it on Twitter and then showing up like just to a restaurant, and 20 people showed up, and some of them were shitcoiners and everything. And you know, that's another thing I actually wanted to talk to you about, but so many people came, and it just like fed this energy of just like creativity and like excitement about what's going on in Miami and like how we can all be a part of it, and just meeting other Bitcoiners. Like there's you come out of it energized and excited for like potentialities in the future.
100%.
It's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I miss, we're still in like freaking red zone here in California. It's like 200 or 300 people dying every day in just LA County. So not a lot of in-person meetups just at the moment, but looking forward to getting back to it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it is as much as, like online, you know, social interaction is really helpful and, you know, revolutionized networking. I'm sure like through Twitter and through video conferencing like this. And we were talking about,
Clubhouse,
right?
Yeah.
But they're having the in-person looking you across the eyes, shaking your hands. You know, there's something about that that you can't replicate in a digital space, at least yet.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, VR is getting kind of interesting. You've got the Udi's Reckless VR group that coordinates a lot of those meetings. I'm not there yet, man. I think it's just probably a function of having the young kids, and like I think it skews very European, so the times are always off for me.
Right.
But yeah, I bought the headset. I have one of the newer Oculus ones, and I think I've only put it on like 2 or 3 times, and I've never attended anything social in it. So,
right.
Just not quite there yet.
Yeah. So one of the questions I have is, as you're hosting these gatherings, do you like to have some kind of structure or like limitation in terms of like who's included, you know, things like this, or
well, my
barriers you put up?
Those monthly, the Tech Salon monthlies are always invite only.
Okay.
So they're run very much like those Keith Ferrazzi ones. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, occasionally somebody will bring a friend and that's totally fine, whatever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's not open to the public.
Right.
I don't think I've ever really done much open to the public stuff, unless it was a fundraiser.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. That's just my thing. I like to have I like to have that sort of screener, because you're curating as well. Like you're trying to make sure that it's an enjoyable event. And the problem is, if you have someone that adds a lot of value and then there's a bunch of randoms, what you're going to end up with is something that I absolutely loathe, which is the semicircle, which is a person who's adding value surrounded by a semicircle of people just trying to suck value and like trying to either like impress with bullshit or like interrupting each other to jump over it. And there's always some dude that drank too much red wine and is spitting on everyone. And it's like, it's just absolutely atrocious. Hmm. And I think I was inoculated against that in business school when I saw the behavior of my classmates and, you know, was getting sucked into it as well. Cause it just seemed like the way that you did these recruiting events was, you know, you'd go and there'd be like consultants or bankers or whatever. And there's like a semicircle of business school students trying to get, you know, someone who graduated 2 years ago, trying to get their attention and like curry favor in some way to try to get noticed or whatever. And it was just so fucking disgusting. I would just like go and hit the spread and just get dinner.
Right.
And then like try to pick somebody off for a one-on-one, maybe, otherwise, whatever. You know, just not my thing. I don't think like stilted, funky, weird networking is human or useful.
Hmm. Yeah. So, kind of bringing that into the context of Bitcoin meetups, I'd be curious to get your thoughts, like, because what I'm trying to create is a very valuable place for Bitcoiners to connect with each other, right? But I also want it to be a place where new people who are interested and want to learn can come. But I also don't want it to be like a shitcoin spreading phenomenon, you know, or like someplace where just any old schmo who has some agenda can kind of capture like new people's attention. And
I can tell you what I see, which is that I think the successful Bitcoin meetups that add a lot of value, they do actually have some content. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe it's a 2-hour thing, but they are going to get up and talk about a topic for 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And at least then, you know, you kind of set the stage and, you know, say something derogatory about shitcoins during that 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And at least plant in the head of someone who's totally new that there's this thing that exists that's called Bitcoin and these other things are not Bitcoin. And you can get that point across without being a jerk, and you can get that point across by talking about any aspect of Bitcoin. Because you'll talk about how that aspect is important and it's only in Bitcoin.
Right.
Or it only matters to Bitcoin and doesn't matter anywhere else. And I think that helps a lot. So you see that with, you know, the Bit Devs meetups, you see that with the Orange County meetup, you know, there's always like somebody talking about something, mm-hmm. you know, to kick it off, or you have like a half hour of mixing and then a half hour of content and another hour of mixing, something like that.
Right.
It really helps with the promotion too, you know, to get people out to say,
yeah, like,
hey,
we're going to be talking about this topic,
about this particular thing. And, you know, if you know something about it, please bring your comments. If it's new to you, bring your questions, that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. Awesome, man.
You know, but also that there's also nothing wrong with just like mixing it up, because you might just, you know, it's, you're not responsible. I mean, we are and we aren't responsible for the people that get fooled by shitcoiners. Like, it's all top of funnel for Bitcoin anyway. You know, like, if you buy Bitcoin when you're supposed to buy Bitcoin, we can help as much as we can. So I guess what I'm saying is, like, it would be better to prepare content for a meetup, but it's better to have the meetup than not have the meetup, even if you don't prepare anything. So don't feel bad about just like, if you don't get your shit together and like have something to say or recruit a speaker, like still do the meetup. Just know that it's probably on balance incrementally better if you do have some content, mm-hmm. probably in terms of quality of people who show up, usefulness and of the time, et cetera. But, you know, but I'm lazy. Like if I were doing a Bitcoin meetup, I'd probably just say it's happening, you know, and I'd probably like not prepare any content. Here's some questions from the first half hour, and then, you know, take the mic or tell everybody to come around and then talk for 10 or 20 minutes and, you know, mm-hmm. address without hitting it head on, but just sort of address the shitcoinery in the room and refocus it on Bitcoin, kind of redirect the conversation.
Yeah. 100%. I like that.
Yeah.
I mean,
when I'm in these clubhouse rooms that have, you know, Balaji or Lily Liu or Vinnie Lingham or some of these like, you know, intellectual sounding types that spread lies about Bitcoin and promote altcoins. Like, you know, you need to be forceful, but you also don't need to be mean. Like, I don't think Vinnie believes what he says, but like Lily Liu and Balaji, like, I think they believe what they say. And I think they, you know, they think they're doing good things. Like, it's just, they're not. As Nick Szabo once said, like, the most dangerous thing in the world is influential ignorance. And so, you know, a lot of what we do with Swan Education and, you know, my own appearances and when I do battle somebody on Twitter and get in fights, or, you know, take somebody on directly on Clubhouse now, which I often do, I'm usually like the first one through the door. It really is when you spot somebody that's very influential that is spreading untruth. I think the power of a true narrative or narrative that is on firm footing is so much greater than an expedient untrue narrative that will wither away and die on the vine and then soil everyone that has promoted it. And so you don't want to look for things like, you know, I'll give just like a general example, but people that follow me and, you know, see the fights that I have will understand how important I think it is to understand which of Bitcoin's design elements are actually necessary for the network to function versus which of them are actually just arbitrary parameter choices. And we're happy that they have worked to the degree that they have, but we cannot know if they were the optimal choices. We literally just don't know if 10 minutes, 4-year halvings, 21 million coins, you know, 50 coins per block initially, like we cannot know. You can't prove a counterfactual. We can never know if those were the optimal choices. We're happy with what we have in the same sense that I would never, like, you know, trade one of my kids for a random roll of the dice to get another kid. Like, I like everything about them and mm-hmm. I would never trade them for anything. And that's how I feel about Bitcoin. You know, I love Bitcoin like fucking blood. But things like the difficulty adjustment, deciding to use a proof of work blockchain and some of these things that are absolutely necessary to solve the Byzantine generals function are a very different level of importance versus, you know, sort of what I would call like parameter fetishism. which is like just right. getting super fucking obsessed with like halvings and stock to flow ratios and things like that. Like that just don't fucking matter to Bitcoin in the long term.
Right. Right. So yeah, in terms of the, I guess the 21 million number, it's more the essence of just the limited and amountness, right?
That yeah. And well, fixed supply actually fixed is supply, a parameter yeah. choice as well. Yep. What actually is more important is unchangeable monetary policy. So it's the game theory of not, I mean, I think it's a great parameter choice. Probably my favorite is probably fixed supply. But are you telling me that like ETH would win if Bitcoin had 0.01% inflation in perpetuity after 2140? Mm-hmm. I don't think it would. I think Bitcoin right. would still win. You know, so right there, you've proven that, you know, 21 million actually isn't, that, you know, fixed supply isn't important compared to the other things that actually make Bitcoin function. The 0 to 1 is the most important. And from like, you know, from there, it's optimizations.
Gotcha.
Solving Byzantine generals was solving a very difficult computer science problem, which is sending value perfectly and losslessly peer to peer.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, and, you know, it's, I love, what I love is that in the Bitcoin community, there is this constant conversation that's always going on to decipher, you know, what are these essential truths? what is the pure essence of
I've got my shirt with like 21 million and dude, I love yeah. having log charts. Like I love all that shit. I do.
Yeah.
But you know, getting obsessed with those things and not actually understanding Bitcoin, you know, essentially makes you a weak hand because you don't know the truth.
Yeah. So that is for you then been a very like instrumental key in helping you to interact with other like shitcoiners or people promoting untruths and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, cause like you can find people like, let's say like an Eric Wall or an Alex Kruger, and Eric Wall is, you know, a cryptocurrency fund manager and has multiple positions. He understands Bitcoin better than 99% of public maximalists. I disagree with him on some things regarding Ethereum, but he's a ruthless critic of Ethereum as well, just happens to own some in his portfolio. But you know, you can find common cause with someone who's seeking truth because they will point out some Bitcoiners bullshit as well. Right. You know, Alex Greer is a very active trader. I think I don't even know if he manages other people's money at all. I think it might just be his own, you know, prop trading thing, but you know, a ridiculously talented and skilled mathematician, statistician, and trader who understands markets and is willing to be, you know, out there with his opinions. One of the reasons I got really bullish, by the way, in the spring period was he basically moved most of his stack into a permanent hold stack and no longer trades Bitcoin other than like very little around the edges. He punts shit coins on leverage all day and, you know, does DeFi whatever. But, right. you know, the lion's share of his what I assume is a hefty stack is just held in Bitcoin for the long term. And that was very much a Paul Tudor Jones thing. Like we plebs, you know, really latched on to Saylor, but the institutional investors, you know, it was PTJ and Druckenmiller and some of those people this year that changed the narrative for them.
Right. I think it's fascinating how we as humans we make decisions based on like just watching other people. That's what a lot of it comes down to. Like, because in reality, there is only so much processing power that we have in our brains to look at all of the data. And you know, we do trust other people to assess the situations and try to navigate the world in that way. It's always, you know, it's fascinating to me.
Totally agree. I agree. I mean, social signals, they don't get you all the way there. And if they do, then you don't really understand the truth. You have to do your own research, obviously, but I think they can point you in many cases. If you're careful about who you take your signals from, then they can point you, the good signals can point you in the right direction at least. And then you can go do research on that.
Right. One of the questions that I had for you, Corey, is what is something that like concerns you most about where we're at right now, looking at the current landscape of the economy, politics, global geopolitics? What are, at our current stage of Bitcoinization, what are your big concerns? What has you worried, if anything?
I mean, so I guess I am, I'm pretty firmly in the sort of Stratfor Peter Zion camp. There's very little that I disagree with Peter on other than Bitcoin. Like, he just doesn't get Bitcoin and he doesn't understand,
right,
you know, how lacking all of his frameworks and all of his prognostications are without factoring in what's going on with Bitcoin.
Do you think, I almost feel like he hasn't even researched monetary policy, like the Fed and what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, that's to some degree, but let's give Peter his due, because I really think, you know, the frameworks around geography and demography and how they interplay with geopolitics and economies and society and culture and all these different things. Like, Taleb and Zion are probably the thinkers that are like the most Bitcoin that aren't fully orange pilled.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, like the way they think about things, the way they analyze things, the things that they get right are so in line with Bitcoin thought and philosophy, which is why, like, even though Taleb clearly doesn't understand Bitcoin to the degree that we'd like him to, even though he wrote a vague foreword for Safe's book, you know, like, a lot of Bitcoiners still love his work because it's just so well aligned with how we think about things, with skin in the game and thinking about Bitcoin as a positive black swan, which is where we got the name for our company in the first place. And anti-fragile obviously is a big thing with localism and with just setting a protocol instead of like depending on a government to have beneficial leaders or benevolent leaders, I guess, which you can't really trust. A psychopath usually takes the controls. Right. So I guess what I'm, you know, it's, we know that there's going to be turbulent times ahead, and this is less because of the financial systems cracks are really just a symptom of the end of the global order that's been in place since the end of World War II. So it's just been this, you know, this Pax Americana with, you know, for the first time ever, all of the global shipping lanes being held open for commerce guaranteed by the US Navy. And as we become less and less interested in that because we don't have the Soviet Union as a worrisome counterparty anymore. And, you know, it's just been kind of this slow moving train wreck since the early 90s as we've kind of watched these structures lose their authority, lose their effectiveness, and kind of watching the world, you know, essentially balkanize back into their little blocks or into their little sort of like more self-interested, you know, countries or peoples going after their own self-interest to a much greater degree than previously. So I'm very interested to see what plays out over the next decade. I think probably the primary narrative in geopolitics that the most smart people get wrong is thinking that, you know, China has any sort of chance to like surpass the US or overtake the US in any way. That just to me is a hilarious misreading of history and just politics and kind of the way things actually are in the world. You know, this is the greatest footprint that China has held together for any stretch of time in its entire 5,000 year history. You know, it's basically only holding together because the US and the West has basically been complicit in propping up the value of the yuan so that they can buy things. 60% of Chinese GDP right now is subprime real estate loans. Like, it is such a paper tiger. And, you know, this is as hilarious as people fetishizing, you know, the Japanese way and, you know, everyone learning Japanese in the early 90s and thinking the Japanese were going to take over because they bought some buildings in downtown LA and Die Hard was an awesome movie. Like, we were watching Rising Sun and, you know, Sean Connery was going to teach us all how to, you know, be more Japanese so that we could like, you know, live in this, you know, this Japanified world because they're so dominant over everybody. It's like just not the case. And that's where, you know, looking at things the way that Zion does and recognizing that, you know, the inherent geographical or geographic advantages of the United States are so great, whether it's being protected on the west and the east by oceans that people can't cross without us knowing, whether it's having 13,000 miles of navigable rivers connected to farmland and the oceans, which is 1,000 miles more than the rest of the world combined. Things like that. Like we're energy independent. There's an entrepreneurial culture. There's a protocol that we're running on that's been running for, you know, 240 years now, almost 235 years, that appears to bring things back in balance when they're out of balance. And we see that time and time again. And it doesn't mean it's perfect. And it doesn't mean that it couldn't be lots better and that we couldn't have made all kinds of, you know, parameter choices different. But like Bitcoin and like your children, you know, you've got to be pretty happy with what you've got, because, you know, you wouldn't really roll the dice and change much about the progression of the United States to here, because chances are, like, probabilistically, if you look at the success of this country, like, chances are we're probably in like the 90th or 95th percentile outcome versus what could have happened. And right. So the choices have been pretty good, which is again how I feel about Bitcoin. Like, I don't think Bitcoin is, you know, in the 99.9 percentile of all potential outcomes, given that the Byzantine general's problem was solved. But I do think we're probably, like, the fact that it's going what appears to be pretty well, and like, I can't see it not working and sort of holding tyranny in check for the next few centuries to a few millennia, which I think is the grandest goal of Bitcoin, way more than anything else that anybody is looking at. It's that. It's resting power for away from people that would control us is the main thing that we're working on. And every other goal for Bitcoin is secondary and should take a backseat to that. I would never dare to change anything really about the path of Bitcoin to here, because it seems like probabilistically we're probably sitting in, you know, somewhere in a 90 to 99th percentile outcome, and you don't roll the dice if you're doing pretty damn good.
Right. Right. Yeah. So generally you're very optimistic about the American project and us retaining this momentum.
I think they're naturally aligned, and I think Bitcoin makes the US way, way better. I think Bitcoin is the soft landing for the fiat system. I think it's the natural, you know, when the US has a quarter of global wealth, we'll end up with a lot of Bitcoin too. And as long as you let innovation flourish in the Bitcoin space in on and around Bitcoin, and don't get in the way and don't try to maintain dollar hegemony for like no reason other than momentum, when it's actually hurting us more than it's helping us now. And that if you what's also really important about having the right narrative is if you actually understand the inherent advantages of the culture and geography and demography of the United States, then you actually want an even playing field with the money, because we'll actually do better.
Right. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. If it levels the playing field of now work and human energy and resourcefulness is what matters, not manipulation and, warring control, then we're in a pretty good spot.
We don't have European red tape, and we don't have to go through the CCP to set up Bitcoin miners all over the country and to set up mining operations owned by people in the United States all over the world. Mm-hmm. Like, we can just do it, like, right now. You can go set up a wind farm in West Texas, and you can go do some hydro out in Eastern Washington, and like, you can do whatever you want, or you can partner with some Canadians and give them a rip and set up, you know, upstream data style, you know, gen sets at leaking natural gas and, you know, burn it for Bitcoin instead of flaring it off into the atmosphere. Like, there's nothing stopping us unless we're just stupid.
Right. Right. That's a very, very optimistic, response to my question of, you know, what you're most worried about. Is there something in there that you'd like for the Bitcoin community in particular to really focus on, that like, where maybe something we're missing?
So I think there, anytime there's disruption on the scale that I expect from sort of, you know, the two things, one, you know, the end of sort of Pax Americana and then the rise of Bitcoin and collapse of weak fiat currencies and eventually like medium strength fiat currencies. And then we'll see how long the strongest fiat currencies survive. I think it could be, you know, a long time that they're still around. They'll just, those central banks will own Bitcoin too.
So it's going to be,
there's always, there's entrepreneurial opportunity in all of those things. So you're going to have new problems. We're going to solve a lot of problems where they'll just kind of go away because they're just like not relevant. So the kind of like the effects of a lot of things that we worry about today just kind of fade away faster, the faster that Bitcoin rises. But we'll have a lot of other issues that we face that we can't even necessarily foresee. So it's great to spend a lot of time, you know, thinking with people who understand Bitcoin and where it's likely to go, and also have experience thinking about, you know, politics, about economies, about poverty, about all kinds of things, and kind of getting out ahead of some of these things and at least having, you know, a menu of options like, okay, well, these three things might happen that are bad, and here are three or four ways that we could, you know, address each of those three potential bad things, and kind of have those draft plans in your hip pocket as you start to watch it and be adjusting your hypotheses. I mean, you know, everyone from the Cato Institute to, you know, Council on Foreign Relations to McKinsey to, you know, Google to everybody is going to have strategy teams working on everything related to Bitcoin, you know, and what it does to the world. So you're not in this, like, it's not just us on Bitcoin Twitter thinking about this. Like, this is every level of government, every company, every think tank, you know, every structure that includes humans that have brains will be thinking these things through. So I think sometimes we get kind of overwhelmed. But, you know, you can just like, my optimism is like, it's summed up by Gwerin's 2011 piece, you know, Bitcoin is, and that's enough, you know, and Bitcoin changes us. We don't change Bitcoin. And so we're all going to kind of adjust to the introduction of a new element into our world that is Bitcoin.
100%. I can see that. It's really, it is reassuring to know how the buy-in to the Bitcoin network can, it really does change your perspective, and it prolongs your, like what I've experienced in my own, just my own life, like prolonging my awareness of like what I'm preparing for and what I, it's extending my time preference. It's doing all these things for me to think about my sphere of influence and how I can improve it. So the more people are being attracted to this thing, like a magnet, the more powerful that element of change can really impact the world. So it's really exciting.
So we've Homo sapiens has been around for 300,000 years now. We invented good money, sound money that actually works for humans. We've had that for 0.003% of human history the last 12 years. 1% of humans have owned even a tiny little sliver of that sound money for 0.00067% of human history the last 2 years. That's when we kind of crossed over to 70 million people owning a little bit of Bitcoin. Was
right,
you know, a couple years ago. So it's freaking early. Adoption matters more than anything. The whole thing is, you know, increasing demand against fixed supply. Like, That is what drives the entire market, is adoption, adoption cycles, adoption narratives, looking for ways to get people interested in Bitcoin, leading them down the funnel, customer journey, all that kind of stuff. Like it really is all about evangelism, education, social signaling, showing people ways to make money, in the Bitcoin ecosystem or leveraging Bitcoin. And the incentives are there because it is better money than we've ever had before. So at a minimum, the incentive is there to, exchange your shitty money for better money. But there are also all kinds of, cool things with the Bitcoin network that incentivize companies to take advantage of Bitcoin. Things like, when PayPal has people transacting over PayPal without Bitcoin, people almost never store any value in their PayPal account. You put money in there, you spend it, and somebody receives it and they take it off platform as fast as possible. And PayPal has to make payouts to partners on both ends of those. But if people actually store value in their PayPal account, which they're much more likely to do if it's Bitcoin, they're charging the same fees on transactions, but they don't have to pay anybody out. So it's very selfish. It's self-interest guides that, right? Mm-hmm. Self-interest guides, Veeam and Strike and another dozen companies doing remittances that leverage Lightning Network or blockchain transactions. I mean, batch transactions are, essentially free still anyway, if you're doing 100 at a time. They're using something that exists. I mean, I don't know if I've whipped some money around the world. It's just like, it's beautiful. Like paying a contractor in Bitcoin is just, it's amazing. I love it. I still love it. Mm-hmm. I've been doing it for almost 4 years and I just absolutely think it's freaking awesome to just send money over the internet instantly. And companies that are starting to take advantage of that and understand it and, getting used to the Lightning Network and how that works and all the other innovation that's coming. It's just, I just think we're going to see just such an explosion in global productivity and then just being able to actually like save the excess value that you gain from being productive in something that doesn't inflate away. It's just going to make a lot more people like want to play that game, it's cool. Like if you're going to make a little bit of money and it's going to inflate away anyway, welfare sounds okay, whatever. But if I could save some and I think that's, it's going to be able to buy more in the future because technology is deflationary and the money is, deflationary. And so, even if I have less Bitcoin in the future, I'll be able to buy way more goods and services with my smaller stack. Like that's freaking cool, man.
Yeah. Yeah, man. I'm with you. And what it makes me think about at one of the things that you mentioned was more and more of us plebs wanting to come in and wanting to make money and we're selfishly incentivized to make as much of this Bitcoin as possible and make our stack as high as possible. And that's a great thing because it's making us desirous of this new monetary asset. What advice do you have for people who, like me, where I'm coming into this thing, I want to contribute. I want to learn as much as possible. And I'm sure there's so many others like me that are here learning and loving it, but wanting to contribute and also wanting to take part in the action. Like we want to, we want to be a part of the revolution. We want to, stake our claim right in the Bitcoin world. So what advice do you have for us as we're networking, trying to offer value and really contribute in ways that are mutually beneficial?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's, in companies, there's generally like the engineering side and the business side, especially in startups. Like it pretty much just breaks down to like, there's the business team and there's the engineering team. So if you're an engineer, then you kind of know how to do that. You find companies that are doing cool things in and around Bitcoin, and you hope that your skills either are already valuable or that you can learn something that is valuable and that helps you get a spot. And, you know, engaging with people on social platforms seems to be like a really good way to sort of get noticed. And so if you're willing to do that, even as an anon or a pseudonymous person, then I think it's worth spending that time and at least getting your profile known. And then you can kind of like slide into DMs and, you know, let them know who you are once there's like an actual opportunity or something like that. On the business side, I think it really just comes down to like quality of thought. And skill, I guess, and experience. So, you know, if you're going to do business development for one of the larger companies, then probably your business development skills are really important. If it's a smaller company, then it's probably more about, you know, being kind of a jack of all trades or being more of a generalist. And you're probably going to find those companies again by engaging, by putting some content out into the world, by asking good questions on Twitter, Clubhouse, or whatever. And just kind of getting to know people that way, and then being a hand raiser and offering to do things, you know, in your spare time or whatever. I mean, Swan, the path to getting on the Swan team that seems to have worked the most is like engaging with us on Twitter, raising your hand and offering to do something for free or for cheap that we need done. And then, you know, getting in the team Slack and uncovering other things that you can do. And before long, you're indispensable and you're working for Swan. Right. So that's happened over and over again. With our people, they usually, you know, it starts on Twitter and somebody sends me or Jan a DM and asks if we need help with something. And we're like, well, yeah, we kind of need help with everything. What can you do?
Right.
You know, but yeah, we pretty much hire exclusively from Bitcoin Twitter.
Right. Awesome, man. It's really helpful. I think that there's just so much opportunity. There's, like you said, there are going to be so many problems that need to be fixed, that need to be, have human attention and energy put into. And, I'm really confident in like our ability as humans to tackle these situations. So, it's exciting to just be a part of this community and talk to people like you who are helping people get, I mean, that's like one of the biggest things, right? The connection between the fiat and legacy system to the Bitcoin system. You're operating in that as that interface, right? Of like people who are entering in, plugging into the Bitcoin network. It's so exciting.
I mean, we're working toward our own obsolescence, right? Like we want to switch all the fiat over to Bitcoin. then we'll have to do something else. But I think that will take a while. I don't think they're done printing fiat anytime soon.
Right. Before I let you go, I just have one question that I like to ask people is, what's something that you know is true but no one else believes?
I don't know about no one else, but you could probably say like few believe.
Okay.
Yeah. Trying to get you back in focus there.
Yeah. I'm not, sometimes the camera goes out.
That's an interesting one. This is the, at the beginning of Peter Thiel's book, 0 to 1.
Yep.
I don't know. I guess it's tough, man. I think I've said everything and found some people that agree with pretty much everything I've said over the last year. So I have to come up with something like totally new on the spot.
That's what's crazy about the internet is like you think that you're the only one. Like I was the only Bitcoiner that I knew for a long time.
Yeah.
And then I started talking to people on the internet and then there's
a Oh, well, listen, I wish that I think we can talk about Clubhouse. I don't think there are very many people that understand how big that platform is going to get and how quickly it's going to move. So they just announced yesterday that they closed their B round at $1 billion valuation with another big check from Andreessen and friends. That was 8 months after they raised at 100 million. So they 10x'd in 8 months. I've only been on the platform for a month and I was just starting to put some feelers out and see if I could like sneak into a fundraising round there. But my forecast is that the valuation of Clubhouse, within 24 months. So let's say by, uh, by January 31st of 2023, will be over $100 billion. I think it's an easy 100x in 2 years. That is the best altcoin out there.
Duly noted.
Yeah. So
that's quite the prediction.
I think the way that it lets you engage with people, and I think Twitter Spaces and Telegram voice rooms or whatever are completely DOA. It's a different social graph. It's a different type of engagement. I don't want to engage with my Telegram groups the way that I engage with people on Clubhouse. I have no interest in starting up rando rooms on Facebook, which has already, Facebook has rooms. Nobody uses them. It's a failure. It sucks. You know, basically can like spin up a video or audio chat right out of a group. Nobody uses it because that's not the graph you want to do that on.
Right.
You know, the people who are good at hosting rooms and doing audio content are people that are going to be good at that. And they're going to be on Clubhouse doing exactly that. I'm super bullish on that. We are spending an insane amount of time. Our whole team has carte blanche to spend as many hours and get your job done. But every other waking hour that you want to be on Clubhouse, just getting to know it, developing a spidey sense, building connections, meeting new people. It's just awesome. I'll give another one, which kind of spins out of Clubhouse a little bit, which is the algorithm on Bitcoin or on Twitter is just way too tight and doesn't let you see much outside of like your very core group. And so it really puts people into silos pretty quickly, unless you're super careful about creating lists, which nobody does. So it requires you to take action to see anything outside of your own little filter bubble. Clubhouse, from what I'm seeing so far, ain't going to be like that. It's way too easy to discover people completely different than you. It is making people that are ridiculously toxic on Bitcoin Twitter and turning them into like, you know, teddy bears, you know, handholding people through the gentle version of, you know, why you might not want a shitcoin, and like, these are some pretty cool things about Bitcoin, and here's this nice resource. And you're finding out, like, you know, from Stop and Decrypt to American HODL to like all to Bitcoin Tina, like when you're talking to humans in real time with voice, it's so different than just being a keyboard warrior. And people see that and they realize it. And I think it has a good chance of being, there's already a pretty, unfortunately, already a pretty, I don't want to say the word segregated, but there's definitely like black Clubhouse, like there's black Twitter, but there's also a lot of crossover. So, you know, the Black Bitcoin Billionaires group is the largest Bitcoin group on Clubhouse, which is awesome. But a lot of their members will pop over to the, you know, the Bitcoin Twitter-ish sort of ones. And, you know, I'm personally trying to spend as much time as possible in their rooms and getting to know them. The guy who created the group is Lamar Wilson. We just had him on Swan Lounge on our show on Friday. Just kind of like letting people know that this guy who's like a hardcore engineer with an encyclopedic knowledge of Bitcoin that no one on fucking Bitcoin Twitter even knew existed is educating way more people than 90% of Bitcoin podcasters on his Facebook group and on Bitcoin Clubhouse with rooms bigger than ours. And, you know, and I didn't know, and it's embarrassing because I didn't know he existed. I never found out about his Facebook group. You know, I had to find out about him on this new platform, and I love the guy. And I can't wait to do like tons of good work with him, you know, spreading Bitcoin knowledge and learning, you know, from the way that he educates people, which is very different stylistically than what I've generally, than anything that I've seen really. It's much more generous than the way that Bitcoiners usually talk to people.
So what particular aspect of it is more generous? Just by providing that open forum.
Well, it's providing the open forum, but like also just like not judging the questions of the newcomers and not judging their views. I think it may just be time on platform. I think he's been on Clubhouse and kind of doing this, you know, talk radio sort of vibe. It's like group talk radio kind of with great moderation tools. And I think he's just gotten really skilled at it. And so it does seem like, a lot of the Bitcoiners are getting better at that. I should say the white Bitcoin Twitter speakers are getting better at that, which is great. But yeah, I think there's a lot to be gained, and you just, it forces you to engage with people as humans, and the bar for what you would call somebody like a real scammer. Yes, they're there and you can call them out, but like a lot of people just don't know yet or have like slightly different views or slightly different takes on it. I'll give an example. One of the guys that's worked on Shapeshift forever, John, I don't know his last name, but I think he runs product over there and he's been working with Voorhees forever. Like that dude can talk about Bitcoin all day and loves Bitcoin more than 98% of Bitcoin maximalists. I fundamentally disagree with some of his views on altcoins and where he thinks some of those things are going. But can he politely sit in a Bitcoin room and moderate and handle the room by himself when Bitcoiners are gone and not push his altcoin views because he's under like the Bitcoin aegis for that hour? Absolutely. And he just answers questions about Bitcoin and recommends what he truly believes, which is that everybody should buy Bitcoin first. And that's where you should start. And he's an asset to Bitcoin. And I would not have thought that. I mean, I went to Bitcoin 2019 in San Francisco and I saw, you know, Voorhees in his Bitcoin t-shirt. And I was like, oh, what a fucking scammer. He's orange washing, you know? But when you engage with someone on his team that presumably thinks very much like Eric does, and then, you know, it was like, well, shit, and I'm going to go watch that thing again. I watched his debate with Peter Schiff from a few years ago where he, you know, argued for Bitcoin. And it's like, man, that dude really, really does kind of get Bitcoin and he really does like it. Like maybe I don't need to be so mean to him, even though I totally disagree with him on shitcoins. Like he really does like Bitcoin and he's done a lot for it.
Right.
Anyway, so it's kind of, I don't know. It might help make Bitcoiners both nicer without giving up any of our natural scam fighting instincts and the white blood cell activity that toxomaximalism provides, while also still, I think that because of the nature of the engagement on an audio platform where you actually have to talk to other humans and hear the pain in their voice or whatever, just forces you to be more human too.
100%. Yeah, it is. It's very humanizing, a much more humanizing experience than just text on the page. And I like that a lot.
Yeah,
Corey, thanks so much, man, for coming on. Is there any other final thoughts that you'd like to share with the audience? And
I mean, no, this is good. It's good hanging out. Nice to meet you. I'm sure I'll see a lot more of you now. I guess shill a couple of things just for your listeners. So we give away Jan's book, Inventing Bitcoin, which is my personal favorite introduction to the subject. So if you go to swanbitcoin.com/freebook, you can give that link to anybody, any friend, family, social network, post it on social. We don't care. We'll give it away. Audiobook or ebook for free. So that's cool. We also, a few months ago, launched Bitcoin TV, which is 24/7 Bitcoin educational content. So you can go to bitcointv.network and grab that stream anytime. It's a YouTube channel too. So if you have YouTube on a smart TV, you can just bookmark it or whatever. And I keep it on my second monitor all day. It does have a price ticker at the bottom.
Nice.
So you can sort of guilt-free.
You also get there by CornHub.
Cornhub.tv well, right? is another shortcut. Another shortcut. Yeah. Also check out swanxrp.com, which a fan recently just put up, which is a hilarious spoof website. Swanxrp.com. I think it's basically like get poor quickly or something. I don't know. I mean, I think that's the main thing. Yeah. Definitely check out, you know, swanbitcoin.com. For the first, you know, 9 months or so, we required people to sign up for a recurring purchase plan before buying Bitcoin. We've actually removed that very recently. So you can just go and check it out, make sure it works. We have, you know, free automatic withdrawals, you know, instant purchases via ACH transfer. And you can also wire large amounts if you want to go that route. So kind of serving all needs now for your Bitcoin buying desires.
Yeah, that is excellent. That's especially the white glove service that you're talking about with
kind of known for that. Swan Private. I mean, if you run it, well, you know, we say that, but everybody kind of gets that too. Like, I think everybody gets the personal touch at this point.
Yeah. But, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. It's, I think it's a little bit more of, starting that brand is a little bit more about actively prospecting for those people.
Okay.
Right. But the service is essentially the same across the board. It's just a shiny new shingle.
100%.
Yeah. Corey, all right.
Thanks so much, man, for coming on.
Yeah. My pleasure, John.
I'll end it there.
Okay.
That was excellent. I appreciate your time, buddy. That was a great conversation.
It was really fun. You're a good interviewer. We got to do more of this. When did you start your show?
I started at like the end of November. So I've got 15, this is going to be number 15.
Okay. And it's, YouTube as well.
Yep. Yeah. I've been on YouTube, published on the channel there, and then streaming, like going from my website to, you know, from Castos to Apple and Spotify and all the other platforms on audio. Yeah.
Nice, dude. Oh, that's good. Yeah. We should have you on Swan Lounge soon for sure.
Yeah, man. I'd love to join.
For some reason, I thought you were in Europe.
Oh, well, I guess my profile picture, it's at the Louvre. So
maybe that's it.
Maybe that's why.
Yeah. All right. I'll ping Brady and Brecky. I have your email address, so I'll just make an email introduction. We'll get you on soon.
Cool. Yeah. And always, happy to, I'll be in Miami for the foreseeable future at the moment, at least for the next few months. If you guys are ever down here, I think they're
thinking about doing the conference there.
The 2021 conference. 2021, I really hope they do.
Me too. It'd
be very fortuitous from my perspective, but.
Yeah. I mean, Miami looks like it's going to make a bid for being the Bitcoin capital of the US. I would very much welcome that. I think it's actually a much better headquarters than Austin.
Do you think
much more international, much more fun.
Yeah.
Much less crowded. Austin is just such a shit show already. I mean, it's like, it's too late to move to Austin.
They're just trying to build it. They can't keep up right with how many people are there and everything.
Traffic is stupid. And the homeless situation is fucking ridiculous. And it's already overcrowded.
Yeah. Being here for the last month and kind of exploring it, it really is crazy how much room for growth there is in, just within the city itself. Like,
there's like stretches of like 30 blocks where nothing's over two or three stories in Miami. Mm-hmm. Like, is so much room to grow.
Right. Yeah.
Good, man. Well, it's good hanging out. I'm going to get some shit done, but, we'll talk soon.
Definitely.
All right. Peace out, John.
All right. See you, man.
All right. I hope you guys enjoyed that session. Thank you again, Corey, for coming on and sharing some great stories and insights around your personal experience and career when it comes to networking and in general and working the business end of the Bitcoin community. I think this was a really beneficial conversation for a lot of people, and I think we'll get a lot of value out of it. Also, thank you all for listening in. I really appreciate you being a part of this project, and I hope you're enjoying it. Feel free to offer any feedback that you want, and make sure to subscribe, check the like button, hit the like button if you like it, and share it with anyone that you think might resonate with the message. This is truly just a passion project of mine that I hope to improve, and I hope that it benefits all of you who are listening. So if you want to check out more episodes or events or learn more about how to support the show, be sure to visit thebitcoinpath.com. And until next time, may you live a meaningful life and enjoy your freedom as a sovereign individual.